Okay. Erev Tov, good evening everyone from beautiful downtown Elkana in the Jewish Shomron. We're going to just do a very brief review. Reik sugyot, that is sugyot that are built on a skeletal structure of memrot that are in chronological sequence. In the first sugya, we saw a series of memrot from Bavel, from Rami and Rava and Rabbi Zera. And in this second sugya, we're seeing a very different kind of Amoreik sugya. We're seeing the generation being brought by Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, one of his prime pupils. And then we have a response to Hanan by Rav Papa and Rav Zvid, who are fifth generation Babylonian Amoraim. And if you will recall, the principle that Rabbi Yochanan laid down in our sugya was that when we say that the Shomer Chinam has to pay in order to acquire the rights to the double damages from the thief, but that doesn't mean he had to pay, literally pay, but he had to take a commitment that he was going to pay. And that a commitment to pay, Hareini Mishalem, is the equivalent of actual payment for the purpose of rights to the double damages. And on top of that remark, in component number 4 in the second sugya, Rav Papa extended the principle of Rabbi Yochanan to the 4 Shomrim. And he said, Shomer Chinam Kevan She'amar Pashati, Shomer Sachar Kevan She'amar Nigneva, Shoel She'omer Hareini Mishalem. And that what Rav Papa is doing is he's saying that these statements on the behalf of these Shomrim, when the Shomer Chinam says Pashati, that automatically obligates him in payment to the owner of the object being guarded. And therefore, it's like Hareini Mishalem, which is what Rabbi Yochanan says at the beginning of the sugya. And similarly, this is true of the Shomer Sachar with Nigneva and the Shoel that says Hareini Mishalem. However, we noted that there were two different versions of Rav Papa. The first being Hareini Mishalem is not enough to acquire the rights to double damages. And in component number 5 of the sugya, we see in Nusach of Rav Papa, once he says Hareini Mishalem has rights to the double damages. And therefore, we see that this sugya starts in Eretz Yisrael. It proceeds afterwards in fifth generation Babylonia among the students of Rava. And this is where we got up to last time. Now what we're going to do this evening is try and concentrate on the stem of the sugya, the stem of the Gemara in sugya number 2, and if we have time, to take a look also at sugya number 3 in your riveting pages. Take a look at the stem of the Gemara on the second sugya. And there are several blocks of stem of the Gemara. The first is component number 2. And I'm sure you've had hours to prepare this sugya in advance of our timely meeting this evening. And therefore, you probably have had a chance to look at number 2 and see what it's doing. The component number 2 says, brings the Mishnah, Shilem v'lo ratzal, that since it says Shilem, that he paid, that the Shomer Chinam actually paid, the Stama wants to conclude Shilem in, lo Shilem, lo, that only if he paid, actually physically paid, does he acquire the rights to the double damages. But if he didn't pay, then he doesn't acquire them. But the later part of our Mishnah says, Nishba v'lo ratza l'shalem, tama d'lo ratza, haratza afapi shelo shalem. That even if he said he wanted to pay, even if he didn't actually pay, that would be enough for him to acquire rights to double damages. So as it were, the inferences drawn from the two parts of the Mishnah are contradictory. And therefore the Gemara says in line 2 Gimel, Ela miha leka lemishmamina, that it's impossible to induce any, or for that matter, any hindrance to Rabbi Yochanan as brought down in component number one. So this was an attempt of the Gemara, mimedayik, from the Mishnah in support of Rabbi Yochanan. But then, in component number three, the Stama says, Tanya kavate de Rabbi Yochanan, that we have a brayta in keeping with Rabbi Yochanan. Hasocher paramecha de'amar hala hareini mishalem ve'ini nishpa ve'achar kach nimsa ganav mishalem tashlume kefel la socher. And the but also with reference to a socher, that the same rule would apply, that the minute he says hareini mishalem and he becomes obligated in payment for the lost object, he acquires rights to the double damages. And this piece of stoma, this braita, which is being brought as part of the stoma, has two functions. Number one, it confirms Rabbi Yochanan's principle regarding the Shomer Chinam. And second of all, it expands the field of the discussion from the Shomer Chinam to the other types of Shomrim, because the braita is dealing with Socher. And that leads us then very nicely into Rav Papa's Memra, which about the Shomer Chinam, the Shomer Sechar, and the Shoel. And we see here what the Stama is trying to do. The Stama, who is the Magid Shir, the one who is giving us the added value over and above the statements of the Amoraim, this Magid Shiur is connecting the various parts of the Amoraic Sugya one to the other so that we can understand the flow of logic, which we may have or may have not understood by ourselves from the Amoraim alone. Are there any questions on this first part of the stoma before we go to the next piece of stoma? Okay. The second piece of stoma is in component number four. In component number four, we have which, having corrected them according to Eitan's remark last week, are simply Shomer Chinam Kevan Sheamar Pashati, Shomer Sachar Kevan Sheamar Nigneva, Shoel Shomer Hareini Mishalem. Lo. And that is just the Hebrew components. The last few words of each sentence, which are in Arabic, are not part of the Memra, they're part of the linguistic polishing Stama de Gemara by the Magid Shir. Now look what the lines of the Stama do after each one of these lines of Rav Papa. Shomer Chinam Kevan Shomar Pashati, says Rav Papa, the Stama adds, because since the Shomer Chinam is exempt from damage for something that's stolen, he could have said the object was stolen and therefore I don't have to pay anything. But since he said Pashati, what happened was my fault, then he accepts obligation to pay. So we see that what is the Stama doing? It's kind of filling out. It's like the next line, Di'iboy Patarnav Shehu Meta. And in the third line, the Stama explains why Rapha did not acquire rights to double damages simply by accepting responsibility for what happened. Because since he has, after all, so much benefit from what's going on there, he has the rights to use without payment, he has to actually pay or it doesn't work. And the Stama also tells us that the Shoel could not exempt himself from payment with just a claim, just by saying that it died from normal work, because that's not a common occurrence, and therefore we require evidence. And then you see, so what the Stama is trying, Papa. In number five, component number five, where we have the second version of Rav Papa, then the Stama again is saying, "Di boy patar nafshei b'meitah machmat malacha." There it's saying that even though the animal dying from normal use is unusual, it still is acceptable enough for the shoel to acquire rights to the double damages from the thief by claiming it. And therefore, number four and five are really one unit, where the Stama is interpreting the Memra of Rav Papa. This is called Perush HaMemra. This is in distinction to what we saw in component number two and in component number three, because there it wasn't Perush HaMemra, it was rather attempting to connect the Memra or to the Mishnah or to to a brighta, that strength of seven. In component number six, we have Amar Le Rav Zvid, Hachi Amar Abaye, Shoel Ad Shi. Actually pays my tama, and what is this? Shelo b'bura lo miknele feda. Why is this so? Because since he has all the benefits, borrower, he has use without payment. He's not a renter, and he's not a guardian. He has the right to use it, and he doesn't have to pay. Then it's not enough for him to speak and put in, and what he has to put in, of course, is the payment for the lost object. And what, therefore, what is the function of component number 6b? What is it? What is it more like? Component 2 and 3, or component, or the stem in component 4 and 5? That is correct, Eitan. It's more like component 4 and 5. It is Perush Hamimra. Very good. Back up Rav Zvid, the Kidem Hashoel Vishilem, the Harkach in Saganav, Mishalem Tashlume Kefel Hashoel. And that means that only when he actually paid, and not when he simply claimed something that would entitle him to the payment. So these are brightot of Tanya Kavate de Ploni, where there's a brighta that seems to back up a certain Amorek Shita, are common throughout Shas, and we have two examples of them here. Now in component number 7, it's not Pirush HaMemra, and it's not a connector between the Amora and the Mishnah and a brighta, but rather it's a logical inquiry by the stoma. Lilishna kamadur of papa, vadai lo havyati. The first version of Rav Papa, the brighter that we just read, El, must pay in order to get double damages. That's fine, because in his first version, Rav Papa said the same thing. Lilishna batra lema tihavit yufta. But shall we say, according to the second version of Rav Papa, that this brighter will be a disproof? Because there in the second version he said that the borrower, the shoel, could acquire rights to double damages by declaration and not only by payment. So Amar Lach Rav Papa, Amar Lach Rav Papa, Rav Papa would say to you, Mi Alima Mima Nitin de. Hachamar Rav Papa, but Amar Lach Rav Papa. And this is the stama saying Rav Papa would say to you, or Rav Papa could say to you, or Rav Papa should have said to you. But it's a supposition, a speculation of the stama about Rav Papa, how Rav Papa could answer the claim. Amar Lach, of course, is to be distinguished from Amale. The Amora is saying to another Amora directly. The problem is that in many Kitve Yad, in many manuscripts, Ach and Amar Le are written as Aleph Lamed. And therefore sometimes when later scribes opened the Aleph Lamed to words from an abbreviation, when it should have said Amar Lach, sometimes they put Amar Le and gave us the impression that the Amor himself said something, when really he did not. It was being said by the stoma for him. And that always has to be checked when you're learning a sugya. Okay, now let's go on. So what does Rav Papa answer? He says, this brayta is certainly no stronger than our Mishnah. Our Mishnah said shilem, and we said that it could mean also not just payment, but verbal commitment to pay. So in the same way, when the brayta says the same thing, says shilem, it could just mean verbal commitment to pay and not pay itself. This is an argument of the stama to compare the language of the Mishnah and the Braita. But then the Gemara asks itself, midame, is it really alike, the case of the Mishnah and the case of the Braita? Hatam lo katani kidem, hacha katani kidem. The Mishnah doesn't say kidem v'shilem. And advanced payment. Advanced payment. That is, he really paid. Kidem v'shilem. And therefore, you can assume that it means real payment and not verbal obligation to pay. The Kidem v'amar. That it just means that he advanced obligation to pay, even if he didn't pay actually. And so you can see, we don't have to finish the last lines. The main point is that I want you to see from this stoma is how different it is from the stoma of Perusha Memra, and it's different from the stoma attempting to connect the Amora to the Mishnah. This stoma is attempting to analyze at a deeper level whatever has been said earlier. And welcome to Dov from Brooklyn, who just stepped in. Okay, are there any questions about the stoma of this sugya before we move on to sugya number 3? Please hold down your audio transmitter and speak, or write an email, or write a chat. Yes, but whoever that is, please speak up. Turn up the volume. Yosef, turn up the volume on your on the screen.
But I wanted to know if this was...
referring to the beginning of this sugya, or the back?
Rabbi, can you repeat the question? I didn't hear it that. I'm sorry. I don't know. Other people didn't hear it, but I couldn't hear the question from my end. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I couldn't hear it completely myself. Yosef, could you please repeat your question and speak well into the mic?
You said that this is a unique kind of stomach. I just want to know if it was similar to the beginning of our Gemara by the Mishnah of Tritha, where they analyzed the Mishnah, or if that was a unique kind of stama there.
Okay, that's a different kind of stama, because the stama that you're pointing to at the beginning of our Gemara, the Tzrichuta, that's what we call patterned argumentation. Because the Tzrichuta is a set pattern in stoma that appears about 1,000 times in Shas, and it's a pattern. What we have here in the seventh component of the second sugya is not patterned. It's just logical argumentation. So it's not really the same. The reason why you thought it was the same, though, is obviously because both are dealing with analysis of the language of the Mishnah. And I understand your point, but one is occurring within a patterned argumentation, and one in patterned argumentation. So really, thanks to your question, we now have four types of stoma. We have patterned argumentation, and we have the non-patterned argumentation. We have Perusha Memra, and we also have the connection of the Amora to the Mishnah. Okay? Are there any other questions? Eitan Diamond is asking from Toronto, how do you check the Amar Lach or the Amar Le? The only way to check it is, there are only two ways to check it. The first is by context. That is, are you dealing with a section of Gemara where you see clearly that there are two Amoraim? Be disjointed and kind of jars the discussion. And the second way that you can tell is by checking in Kitve Yad, which you can now do online. You can go to, for instance, you can go to the Hebrew University manuscript library, which directly on your screen, and from there you'll be able to actually see the manuscripts on the screen. You can pick any manuscript for any page of Talmud and see whether it says Aleph Lamed, Amar Le or Amar Lach. Okay, I think we should go on to the third sugya. If you'll take a look at the third sugya, you'll see immediately from the colors and from the positioning of the lines that it is very different than the first two sugyot that we have studied. Because the first two sugyot that we studied were based on Amoraic material, Amoraic memras, with stoma added on, sometimes before, sometimes during, and sometimes after. But in this sugya, in sugya number 3, you don't see any Amoraim at all. There are no names here whatsoever. We have only stoma de Gemara quoting little phrases from the Braita. Do we all see that? That there are no Amoraim in the sugya. Why is this? The answer is because this is a stoma sugya. It's different than the other two sugyot we've learned, which were Amoraic sugyas. And stoma sugyas deal mostly with conceptualization and abstraction, generalization, and pattern thinking. And this here, in sugya number 3, is a pattern. Let's see if we can identify the pattern as we read through it. The sugya says, Shita amar eni mishalem, v'chazar v'amar harini mishalem, HaKa'amar Harini Mishalem. And then he changed his language and said, I'm not going to pay. And then he changed his language and said, I am going to pay. He said he's going to pay, and we have a verbal obligation to pay. But what if he said, Harini Mishalem, I'm going to pay, and then he changed his language and said, Eini Mishalem, my. What do we do with that kind of a case where he's changed his language to the negative? Eitan is asking, what kind of clues are there on the Vilna page that the sugya is over and a new one starts? The clue is the word pshita, because pshita introduces a new patterned argumentation, especially as you see it here. And the previous sugya is with a conclusion of Gabi Hadadi Tanyan, where they asked a question and they answered it. When you see the word pshita, in a case, is it's using a pattern called the Ella Mai. That it's obvious, but what happens in the case of why? Mia, we say like this, Odilma. Or do we say like that? And then, from there, the Gemara goes on, spiral, to ask one question after the other, each one based on the question before, using the same pattern. A question of a statement of circumstance, and then my, and then mi amrinan, do we say like this? Or dilma, do we say like that? You can see that in 2 bet. You can see it again in 3 bet. You can see it again in 4 bet, and then the questions become then telegraphic without the balance of the pattern in components number 5 through 11. And this kind of a series where the Gemara places a question at the beginning of a sugya, and then after the question, it distances itself from the question with more and more distant circumstances, one after the other, until it gets to the point where there is no possible answer to the question, and therefore it concludes the sugya with teiko, which means let the question stand, because we don't have a clear answer to it at all. This whole thing, from beginning to end, is a patterned argumentation. Pshita, ending, and it has all these steps in between. Sometimes this patterned argumentation will have 3 steps, 4 steps. Here it has many more, but it's all really the same pattern. Okay? Jay is asking, is Teiku going on all the questions or just really the last one? That's an important question you're asking. It's going really on all of the questions. The Teiku is saying, in the same way that we cannot resolve the last and most difficult question, we cannot really resolve any of these questions we had before, which are stated in a form of mi amrinan o dilma. Shall we say, or shall we say otherwise? And all of these questions then become automatically insoluble and are left by the Gemara without an answer. The Rishonim will use the logic built into this pattern in order to resolve issues of halacha. So Jay is now asking, why is there no attempt to resolve the question? Question number one, surely they had ideas. I'm sure that they had ideas, no doubt about it, and the ideas are actually expressed here. Do we say, mi amrinan, ma dar kama adarbe, udilma bamilte kait, vidachoye hu de kamatchele. Those are the two different ideas, but they're unable to... to resolve the structure of this sugya before we go a little bit more into the content. Can I translate one bet again? Certainly. In one bet it says, mi amrinan, he say, and that word amrinan, by the way, the non-ending, nun nun, is a present participle for we. Amre, say, nan, we, amrinan. So how would you say, for instance, we write? You would say, going back on himself, in the same way we said that when he says Eini Mishalem and then he says Harini Mishalem, we accept that he went back on himself there. And in the second case, when he said Harini Mishalem and then he said Eini Mishalem, do we there also say he's kind of going back on himself? Or he's a Milte Kai, he's standing by his original statement, and he's simply pushing him off. When he said Harini Mishalem, he really meant it, but he doesn't want to pay now. So when the guy says, okay, you said you're going to pay, he said, "Lo, Harini Mishalem, I'm not paying you now." So he's just pushing him off, but he really does intend to pay. Those are the two questions I have here about that, about the second case. And once the second case becomes inscrutable, then all the other cases, first of all, when he says Harini Mishalem and then he dies and the sons say they're not going to pay, what's the din there? And here, of course, we were one step away from the original case because we're a generation down the line. Do we say that they've reversed the position of their father, or Odilma, or shall we say the father, what their father said, but they're really pushing the man off? And then Shilmu Banima, can the guardian, can the owner then say to them, no, when I gave your father rights to the double damages, that was because I liked him, but I don't like you, and therefore I don't want to accept your payment. O Dilma, lo shna. Or shall we say he has no right to change the rules of the game at that time? What if shilem lebanim? What if the guardian paid the sons of the owner because the owner had died? What happens then? And then in number five, what if the children paid the children? And what if they only paid half? And what if there were two parot and he paid for one of them? In other words, you see how what's happening is that all of the logical components, the circumstantial components of the sugya are being changed to affect the resolution of our conceptual question at the beginning of the line. And there's really no way to resolve these questions because we don't know what the criteria were in the original case of our Mishnah, and therefore we're kind of left battle to which the Gemara will respond with Teku. Would we then say Hamutzi Michaviro Alav Hara? Well, presumably yes, presumably we would, because of Yado Al Tachtona, that anyone who wants to change an agreement or change an understanding, he's immediately in a disadvantaged position and he has to prove his thing. Same thing here. Okay, are there any questions about those two contradict? What two? Jay, what two things contradict? Eitan is asking, do we assume that these questions were all asked by a single Magichir?
They believe contradict each other in this case. Would mean the Shomer would have to pay. Because he's the Mishana, he didn't fully pay. But if you say Hamotzi Mekabiru Alav HaRaya, then the onus is on the Baal they're proofs that get them money. So those two clawing would actually contradict each other in this case.
They could. But remember that here what we're dealing with is not someone trying to prove a claim against someone else. That would be amotzi mechaviro. Here it's a question of a person changing a commitment that was agreed upon, that it existed. The person's changing the commitment. Everyone knows that he's changing it. So I'm not sure that it's amotzi mechaviro. It might be more a question of kol ha'mishaneh. All right, in any event, Eitan is asking, were all these questions asked by the single magichir, or were they added as the generations went on? And here, Eitan is raising a methodological question which we have not related to in our previous meetings. And that is, are there rivadim, are there layers also in the stomach? Or are layers only there in the amoreic level? And the answer to your question, Eitan, is halavai that we knew. But my impression I've learned is that the stomach of the Gemara also has layers. And I learned this from several things. I learned it, first of all, from Kitvei Yad, where in some Kitvei Yad you can see that additional remark. And I learned it also from the internal structure of the stomach, where sometimes the stomach will come to an interim conclusion, and then it will then ask on itself and continue the other way. And also, it's only logical. After all, the stomach, we know, continued for some 200 to 300 years, exactly the same length of time. It stands to good reason that in a period of 2 to 3 various levels of things that are added into the text and the discourse as we move along. And therefore, it's my assumption that in many sugyas, there are stama argumentation, and it's likely that one magichir
just as a stomach sugya, would you show it like this? You would just like read the whole thing straight? Would you present anything before, you know, how might you, would you do it in order or not?
Do it in order, but you would try to, you teach this pattern, because the pattern is made up of a very strict, go through a process with the students of trying to list all components of the question, that there's a guardian, and there's an owner, and there's one cow, and there's, and then change each one of the components in turn would affect the case, and how would then change of two components affect the case, and how would change of three components affect the case. So they understand that what the Gemara is doing is this kind of a structured reanalysis of things, and then go into the structure of the stomach itself. Does that answer your question, Jay? Okay. I've tried this before, and because you have a lot of cases like this in the it's quite effective. It means that they struggle with the issues before, which is a good idea from a didactic point of view. Are there any further questions on this sugya?
I'm sorry. Nobody has a question. I just want to ask, when you got a Mishnah quoted by the Stama wants to bring in a Mishnah to ask a question. When do you teach that Mishnah before you teach anything, before the Amorim, before the Stama? Is that correct? You want to get them to know what the Mishnah say. then it's only later on you tell them what the purpose of the Mishnah is being brought in, because the Mishnah is only brought in by the Saba, but I assume you teach it first, or would you do it differently?
Okay, well, as you know, Jay, from your experience teaching with this method already, that of course we want to put Tanaitic material first, and then Amoreic, and then Stama. That's true. However, when the Stama is the one bringing in the Braita, or if or an Amora for that matter, is if the Mishnah has a clear relevance to the issue that's being taught in the Mishnah of the Sugya. But if it's an application of the Stama to another topic that is not connected to the Mishnah, then it doesn't do you any advantage to teach that Mishnah at the Tanaitic level of the instruction, because it's just going to confuse the students. It's not connected to the context. So every case there according to inheritance. Someone else wanted to ask a question. They started to speak before Jay's question took the floor. No? No other questions? All right. Let's just go on a little bit. We've now learned three, in these three sugyas, we've learned three types of sugyas. A Babylonian Amoraic sugya, an international Amoraic sugya, and now a Stama sugya. What I'd like us to do is let's just look very, very carefully at sugya number four. And I'd like to ask you, what kind of a sugya is this? Do all of you know how to go about determining what kind of a sugya it is? What you need to do is scan the page, identify the names of the Amoraim who appear in the sugya, and then decide whether the Amoraim that appear in the sugya are in chronological sequence or are they not. So take a look at this sugya, sugya number four. Who do we have in this sugya? Who appears in this sugya? Yes, starting at Amar Rav Huna. That's right, Amar Rav Huna. So Rav Huna appears in the sugya. Who else appears here? Teddy says Shmuel. That's correct. Very well. Who else? Who else? Yes, Rava. Who else? Abaye. Good. Keep going. Who else? Rav Yosef. Right. Who else? Rava. Who else? Good. Rav Ashe. Very good. Who else? Yes, Rav Huna. And at the very end, in component number seven, Rav Huna Bar Tachlifa. And that's correct. All right, so look at all these. Do we have an Amoraic sugya here, or do we have a Stama sugya? And how do we know? Rachel says an Amoraic sugya. 2 points for Rachel. Very well done. That is correct. Rachel, how did you know? Rachel, how did you know that it was an Amoraic sugya? Shmuel says seven Amoraim. Yes, that's true. There are seven Amoraim. But what is the critical factor? Rachel says they're all quoted quite constantly. Well, that may be, but it's not. What is the critical factor that we know that these seven Amoraim form an Amoraic sugya and are not just being quoted by the Stama? There we go, Rachel. They're quoted in order. They're quoted in order. That is right. It's a conversation to a certain extent. Is there conversation here? No, there's no conversation here. Teddy noticed that there's no conversation. There's just statements. No one is saying to anybody else and they're getting an answer. It's just independent names being quoted one to the other. And now Mike from Passaic asks an excellent question. He says, what about Shmuel? Shmuel's not in sequence. Let's take a look at the sequence. Very good. First we have Rav Huna. Rav Huna is a second generation Rosh Yeshiva. Eitan is suggesting, yeah, but there might be some out of order. Isn't Rava a fourth generation? And if so, he comes before Rav Yosef. Very good. Also, good question. Now, let's see how the sugya just falls right when you take a look at it. Rav Huna is a second generation Amora. He's the Rosh Yeshiva in Surah. Now, what is Shmuel actually doing there? Shmuel is not really part of this sugya. He's more a component that goes with the Braita that's being quoted in component number two. He's commenting on number two. So Shmuel is part of the quotation of the Braita. He's not part of the organic order of the Amorai Sugya per se. He's being brought in because the Amoraim are interested in the Braita, and Shmuel comes along. Now, when Eitan asks, do we know that because of the word Ella? Well, we know it. Yeah, we know it. Because, in other words, he's dealing with the content of this Braita. He's not dealing with this, or not with our Mishnah. So Shmuel has to be put in brackets with the Braita. Once Shmuel is in brackets, all of the Amoraim are in chronological sequence, because in component number three, you'll notice that the word, the name Rava, is in parenthesis, and Rava is in square brackets, because it is Rava. In almost all the Kitvei Yad, and the Bach also comes, must be, that it should be Rava. And Rava comes before Rav Yosef as the Rosh Yeshiva and Pumbedita. So we have Rav Huna. Rava is Rav Huna's Talmid. Rav Yosef is Rava's contemporary and the one who inherited the throne in Pumbedita after him. After that comes Abaye, who is fourth generation. After comes Rav Ashi, who's sixth generation. And then Rav Huna Bar Tachlifa, who was also sixth generation, and Rav Ashi again after him. So we have a completely chronological sugya. And therefore, by scanning this sugya, we can see that it's Amoraic, and that clues us that we have to go back and learn the Amoraic sugya first, back and learn the stomach. Teddy is asking, Shmuel is being brought down by the stomach. The Gemara, part and parcel of the quotation of the Braita, which is a number. You see, when the Sugya wants to ask a question in Rav Huna from this Braita, since Shmuel was learned by heart as a comment on the Braita, wherever the Braita goes, Shmuel must follow. He must be brought together. It's part of the same oral memorized unit, and therefore he's here. That's right. We haven't run across it yet. Patience, patience, my master. We will get to it. All right? Our time is up for this evening, but what I have to ask you to do, your mission, should you do accept it, over Shavuot, when you are next Thursday, when you're still working on your chicken and your chopped meat, I'll already be slaving away at my office again on Easter. But what I'd like to ask you to do is see if you can learn the Amoraim in this sugya, and see if you can figure out what's going on its own. Now, Teddy is asking, I went to the Bonaic website and only found... Yes, I'm coming up. Teddy, hang on, I'll answer your question. Database, only found the database for Amorim Tanaim for sale. Beside the Rivadim website, is there any other literature available for the biographic info for Amoraim and Tanaim? Well, it's you found there basically. An explanation. You could go to Mavol the Talmudim of Chanoch Albeck. You could go to Mavol the Mishnah of Chanoch Albeck, Perek Tet, for all of the Tanaim. There's lots of books. So is what we're advertising on our website, and that's. And it's not that expensive. So if you want, you can order it, and we can send it to you. Jay Kelman says, is Albeck still in print? The Mavol Mishnah is in print. The Mavol Talmudim, I'm not sure. Okay, everyone, you should have a chag, sameach. And, Yosef is asking, why is Shmuel in Aramaic? Well, as I explained in our first meeting, Amoraim are in Hebrew 85% of the time, and in Aramaic 15% of the time. And there are various categories of the 15%. And this case, however, doesn't fit any of those categories, and it is an exception. So good that you noticed it, and good that we relayed it.